You are listening to an audio recording from the 2013 Christian Leadership Conference hosted by the M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust and the Stewardship Foundation. Following is Steve Garber's introduction of the conference and its keynote speaker, Dr. Richard Mao.
Good morning to all of you who've come from near and far, and some of you I've gotten to know very well, others I don't know yet, but it'd be a better life for me. You should just know that if we could maybe take a little walk along the Columbia River sometime the next 26 hours and just talk a little bit about why you're here and what you care about and why your organization is a part of this mix. I'd love that. It may not happen, but that's more who I am, so now you know more about me. Well, here we are. One cannot get off the plane in Portland or Seattle without seeing totem poles with their artful, stark beauty. It requires us to remember the first peoples, the first nations that came over land bridges from Asia into the Americas, making this land their land. The airports in Los Angeles and Atlanta, in St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Birmingham don't tell that story. They do not invite us into that story, a painful political story that it is. Some years ago, I went to visit a friend of mine who'd been a student of mine on Capitol Hill. Dan Lewis was his name. He was a native of the American Southwest, actually grew up in Los Angeles. His grandparents lived in the Four Corners area of the Southwest, in the place where Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado meet each other. As a boy, he would go with his parents back to his grandparents' home, and he wondered, with increasing weight and perplexity, why do my grandparents live like they do? But he went off to the university. He eventually came back to Washington for a semester where he was a student where I taught and stayed in Washington, eventually became the director for the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs, working on the staff of Senator John McCain from Arizona. One day, I wanted just to step into Dan's life and to see more of what he did day by day. And so I went over to the building in the Senate, and he was leading a hearing, and around this horseshoe-shaped table where senators of both parties with their directors standing behind them giving counsel and advice to them as they were debating the questions. This was the Indian Affairs meeting room in the Senate, and so beautifully drawn, beautifully imagined all over the room were these panoramas of the American history of Native peoples from all over the country. That morning, I noticed that there were Indian chiefs of Indian peoples from across America, many of them actually from, it seemed to me in my memory, from Montana and the Northwest, who were there with their dark hair, their sport coats, their Wrangler jeans and cowboy boots, typically. And they were weighing in on what the Senate was debating that day and that week and that year. And the longer I listened, the more impressed I was, maybe even more depressed I was, because you could just hear how deep and conflicted the issues were. These were about water debates, about water resources, about who gets water and where water comes from and who owns it and who doesn't own it. And if you just think about that for a minute or two or five or ten, you begin to realize, of course, that that's not a question that's easily asked. It isn't a question that's easily answered at all. It was a very conflicted and conflictual culture that I listened into that day. There were deep differences with no easy answers. Doing justice, loving mercy, walking humbly with God is hard work. It always has been, and it still is. Why does this conversation and this conference matter, dear people who've gathered together for a couple of days in the first week of December? Why are we here in a room like this talking about a topic like this? You see, it isn't only that debate in the U.S. Senate over 20 years ago. Dan moved from Washington back to the Southwest. He became a senior vice president for Bank of America eventually, and working with Navajo peoples in particular. He's a member of the Navajo Nation, working on economic and social development for his people, and then really in different kinds of ways for his people, peoples of these First Nations all over the face of America. Why does it matter for the Stewardship Foundation and the Murdoch Trust that we take up this question? Well, you see, they have a vision for the common good of the Pacific Northwest, and really beyond that, for the whole world. Growing out of the entrepreneurial work of Jack Murdoch and Davis Weyerhaeuser, men whose businesses served their communities, their states and their societies through their work in technology and timber. You see, our world would not be the world that it is without the hard work and generous hearts of these two men and the foundations they brought into being. What's the problem in this matter of convicted civility? What is the problem? Well, you keep your ear to the ground, your nose to the air, and like me, I'm sure all day long in different ways, you have windows into a very polarized public square. It's hard even to imagine sometimes, maybe most days, even talking to each other when you begin to look at how we live together and how we don't live together. 2 weeks ago, I was invited to the premiere showing at the Kennedy Center of a film called Mandela, A Long Walk to Freedom. There were hundreds of people there, so I wasn't the only one at all, but there were a lot of folks there from around the city. And they'd invited three public figures, Colin Powell, John McCain, and Hillary Clinton, to introduce the film. The person who introduced the film was a personality in the internet broadcasting TV world, somebody we see day by day. And he made a sick, sad joke to begin that film. He drew us into this story, talking, of course, about how in a week in Washington as it was, one more time, it seemed like this film, this story of Mandela and apartheid South Africa and conflicted public square life and conflicts going back for generations and politics and economics and sociology and race and religion and all of this bearing down upon a story seemingly so far away in South Africa as it was, and yet in our city, in the sick, dark humor of, as it was that day and that week, how we live in a place not so far from that, it seemed. That was his humor for the day. And we watched the story, and if you've seen anything of the film at all, you know much about Mandela's life, of course. You know, it is a biography of this man growing up as a boy, beginning to think about the wider world, getting educated, taking up the work of the law in South Africa, finding increasingly himself bumping up against long-held practices which excluded him and his people from a public life. The story goes on, and you know eventually he was put into prison and spent 26 years in a prison in South Africa. And most of the story is that story, really, of those days and years and decades, really, in a prison. Coming back out, and among the great, great sorrows of his life at that point, of course, was finding his wife, Winnie, had had a different experience as she held a candle in his honor in his years in prison. And now, rather than joining him in a hope for some other way for South Africa to go, she, in fact, had become more radicalized in a different direction. And she was leading the charge for neck lacing, as an odd, cruel term is, for black people upon black people in her South Africa. Well, the story is not a depressing one, finally. It is a story of hope. But it's a very hard story. The group U2 was asked to create a song for the film, and they did, and it's simply called Ordinary Love. And if we had more time today, I would play it for you, and we would just maybe sit on tables and talk about it. That'd be a good thing to do. What does it look like to have ordinary love, to work out ordinary love? You might even call it common love. You might even call it common grace for the common good. You see, what does it mean to actually take up what we hope for and dream for and are willing to work at, living out our lives in the midst of hard, tough, rough, grisly, messy places, and to simply say, I will choose to do the hard work of love here? If we don't do it that way, we end up with convictions that lead us to other sorts of places. My political adversary isn't my fellow citizen after all, of course, with whom I disagree, maybe even deeply, but he's my political enemy that I must defeat and crush. If it's not going to be ordinary love and Mandela and his own hopes for his own land, it is a vision which says there's no accommodation. We will crush those with differences. It really is as old as the hills, isn't it? It's as long ago as millennia and millennia ago, where we simply said to each other, no, never. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Get over it. That's just the way it's going to be. There's a certain irony, there's a certain providence, of course, that we're meeting here in Vancouver, Washington, just across the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon, where I was yesterday with people throughout the day in the business world who each conversation I took up with these different kinds of people, somehow the name of St. Mark Hatfield came into the conversation. I lived in Washington long enough to remember the days that he walked the streets of my neighborhood. And actually, you could listen in to people who both loved this man and who did not love this man, calling him St. Mark. Those who didn't love the man, didn't love him. They made the choice wasn't because he was cranky or belligerent or ornery or malicious. It's because they wouldn't make peace with somebody trying to have a deeper, longer, visionary life. Somebody who actually was trying to step into the hard work of politics, in the messy realpolitik of Washington, D.C., and to say, it won't be like this anymore. I could tell you story upon story of those stories left behind of this man's legacy over years and years on Capitol Hill. Of things having been done in a certain way, it will be done this way. It has always been like this in the Senate. These are the rules we play by. Hard, stab you in the back rules they are. But that's just the way it's done. And to have Senator Hatfield step in and to say, you see, now that I'm in charge of this committee, it will no longer be like that. If it's only always been eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, politically speaking, well, you see, now that I'm in charge of this, now that it's going to be me who gives leadership to this group of people in a room, it will not be like this any longer. I was with his chief of staff in the senator's office in the early 1990s, I suppose it was. He was still in the Senate, and if you ever were there, maybe you saw that long wall of Abraham Lincoln memorabilia, of pictures and of letters and photos and all sorts of wonderful memories of this good man who was our president 150 years ago. One of the most important places to visit in Washington, D.C. is the Lincoln Memorial. You have, of course, on that one wall on the right as you walk in, all of the words of Lincoln's second inaugural address. And again, if we had more time, it'd be a good thing in a gathering about convicted civility to sit even in a table like this and to read through the address and to ask the question, so what might we learn today from someone like this who gave leadership in a very difficult moment in American history? How did he try to somehow, by his own leadership, by his words becoming flesh, try to draw people together, not over easy done answers, but over the deepest differences we've ever had as a people? And to find that Hatfield, of course, saw Lincoln as a mentor, intellectually, politically, that his visions, his words, were shaping Hatfield's visions and words. You see, that ought to instruct us. I remember some time ago in the late 1980s being with Senator Hatfield in Williamsburg, Virginia, for a celebration of what was called the Williamsburg Charter, which itself would be an interesting document to think about together, too. It was a part of the bicentennial of the U.S. Constitution. It was a gathering of hundreds of people, diverse political, social, economic, racial backgrounds across America, coming to celebrate the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which says what? Well, in its most simple form, it says, there shall be no establishment for the sake of free exercise. The founders and visionaries behind this effort were committed to the idea that somehow we would have to learn to live with our deepest differences. That was the language behind the Williamsburg Charter. How will we live with our deepest differences? And seeing, in fact, in the genius of those who constituted our common life, of agreeing together at the very beginning that there shall be no establishment for the sake of free exercise. Over the last two generations in America, especially in those who were interpreting our laws for us, there's been actually a switching, a reversal, a overturning of the language of that First Amendment, in practice at least. And it seems to me that what gets worked out is that the whole point was there shall be no establishment. We won't even talk about deep differences because we can't do it. And the Constitution and our First Amendment said, no, the whole point is free exercise. So how are we going to get to free exercise? How are we going to get to a place where we actually can talk about, think about, work out deep differences in America, apart from somehow agreeing that these words bind us and that we must give them flesh? Is there a way forward? Well, I think there has. I think there has to be. But it's a delicate dance, really. It's a delicate dance, committed as we are to being e pluribus unum. Can we live together? How will we live together? What is required of us? Well, I would, among many things to say, I will simply offer three habits of heart. And that language is good, of course, habits of heart. It grows out of Alexis de Tocqueville's look at America in the early 1800s, coming in from France, wondering, what's going on across the ocean? They didn't go through what we did. They didn't guillotine themselves to cultural death. What are they doing in this new experiment in democracy? And he eventually called his study simply Democracy in America. But as he analyzed who we were then, he looked very carefully at what he called habits of heart that would be required for America to sustain itself, for America to keep being America over time. A century and a half later, five professors from the University of California, led by Robert Bella at Berkeley, took up this same question. They called their book Habits of Heart. And they were asking the question, where are we a century and a half later from Tocqueville with his analysis? How are we doing with this? How are we doing? Well, a generation ago, in the mid-1980s, which is when the book came out, their assessment, stark as it was, sober as it was simply that we are fraying. The fabric is fraying. We are becoming increasingly unable to hold together a sense of honoring the individual and honoring the common good at the same time. You see, that's the delicate dance. How will we do those together? You see, honor that you're there and that you're there, but somehow we're all here together. It's doing that in a family. It's doing that in a marriage. It's doing that on a street, in a neighborhood, in a city, in a state, in a society. You see, that's the delicate dance that's ours, friends. How we do those together. That's what Tocqueville saw. That's what these professors from the UC system saw a generation ago, you see, and that's us today. They offered two awkward ideas, awkward phrases at least. They're good ideas. They talked about there being two communities of memory that would have to be sustained, remembered, if we were going to hold on to America being America at its best and its truest. They talked about us remembering to remember the community that is called the Republican tradition. And it's small r Republican, of course. It's the tradition which says we are in this together. We actually have a common life together. There is an e pluribus unum, which is the reality of our life together. We actually belong to each other. Somehow that matters to us. And if we somehow lose that idea that in fact somebody who is not like me, doesn't think like me, is my enemy and I will crush you, if that's the only way we have it, if nuclear option actually is the only way for it to get done, then somehow we really lose the ability to hold on to a common life. The second community of memory was simply this. Maybe it's profoundly this. That if we lost sight of our Jewish and Christian tradition, this vision of history and the human condition, which has shaped who we are, that somehow we lose what would be possible for us into the future. It's not a parochial argument. There's no evangelical higher ground in all this. It isn't some sort of Christian America vision at all, really. It's simply saying there are ideas that come out of this intellectual tradition that is simply called Jewish Christian understanding of reality, of history, of human beings, that shapes who we are. One of the teachers to me has been a man named Václav Havel. He was a playwright, became a prisoner, then finally the president of the Czech Republic in the 1990s. Not a Christian, even. I'm not sure. Maybe he was a theist, but it was not somebody making an argument for Christian apologetics here at all, really. But he said repeatedly all over the world, if in the modern world we lose sight of, we lose a memory of God, we lose access to four great ideas, to four great words, to meaning, to purpose, to responsibility, to accountability. He said there's a line in the sand here. You see, if you lose sight of this, you lose these. And so somehow people, with humility, you see, to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with God and our neighbor, there's a humility here written into our own common vocation, isn't there? But somehow to understand why that matters, what Havel could see, and to realize that we are somehow to be stewards of that, we have a contribution to make. And in a room like this, bound by as we are by common convictions about who God is and what God is and who we are in relation to God, you see, in some ways, even means more to us than that. The first is simply to say then to you that the culture is upstream from politics. The culture is upstream from politics. This habits of the heart thesis is true, that we have to hold on to things and be stewards of ideas and stewards of practices if we're going to somehow hold on to the idea that this matters for us to be a people together. And if we lose the ideas, if we lose the history, if we lose the memory, we will not hold on. The second is, we do have something to contribute here. We have something to contribute. And we ought to learn from Havel at this point. You may not know him, you may not read him, and that's okay, really. I'm always intrigued by people who don't buy in to the creed, who aren't in some way making creedal confession, but who say to us, well, you see, looking at history, looking at people, look at the way the world works out, if we lose sight of this, then we lose these. We need to hold on to meaning and to purpose and to responsibility and to accountability. It's not so far from Nietzsche at the beginning of the modern world saying, I am one of the fathers of this. I believe it too, or I don't believe it either. I actually don't believe in God myself. But he said, let's be honest about it, okay? If we don't believe in God, let's stop talking about meaning and morality, okay? Let's just grow up and realize there's a price tag here. Now, we're not parochial about that in the worst sense. We're not being high-minded about that. We're not being stupid or foolish about that. We are, with humility, needing to be stewards of that and to realize, in some ways, dear people, with leadership as you have for organizations, institutions throughout this part of the country, that you are to be stewards of that in the context of your own people and places. The third would simply be that ordinary love matters. Ordinary love matters from the most personal to the most public. It not only matters in South Africa, but of course it matters everywhere for everyone. A few years ago, I was giving a series of talks to a retreat, and a man walked up to me and said, can I get together and talk with you about some things? We got together a week or so later, and he was a lawyer in Washington, and as many are, I suppose, and said to me over a little Tex-Mex cafe, you know, in the Pentagon City area of Washington, D.C., he said, Steve, I've struggled with my sexuality for a long time, and I wanted to talk to you about all that. And we did talk about it for quite a while. He'd spent a number of years in what could be called the homosexual subculture of Washington, D.C., and the more we talked, over our meal together, I listened to him for a long time. I said to him, well, you know, this really is the most tender of all conversations I ever had with anybody, actually. And I went on to talk about why tender seemed to me to be the best word to use. Looked back across the table at me, and he said, you know, I've heard Christians use a lot of words about this business of sexuality and same sexuality and homosexuality and however you want to speak about it. He said, never heard the word tender before. You see, I need that word in my life. I need somebody to say, this is a very tender thing. Thank you. We're not talking, really, as we talk about convicted civility, about anything other than, first of all, being tender about it, of somehow entering into people's lives and realizing and understanding and doing our best to take people into our hearts and to say, somehow, I hear what you're saying. I acknowledge the pain of your life. I acknowledge the estrangement, the alienation, and on and on and on and on. And you see, I understand as a human being myself that this is a very tender thing to talk about. We have kept being friends over the years. Somebody who's with us these days is a friend of mine named Gabe Lyons. And this past month, he led in a conversation on this same topic. Such an embroiled topic it is in America today. Such an estranging, alienating conversation it is to have in America today. Who will we be? What does it mean to love? What does it mean to live alongside of? How will we do it? And Gabe entered in with a man named Gene Robinson, a New Hampshire Episcopal bishop of a few years ago, who raised a great, great firestorm, really, in America and in the church in America. And Gabe, in his own visionary work with the Q Gathering, which tries to bring people together over issues of the common good, brought into Stanford to speak with, in a conversation with Gene Robinson about how will we work this out together, this matter of deepest differences. It wasn't rancorous. It wasn't angry. They didn't finally agree, but they did talk for a good time that evening in public about something which has to be talked about, a deepest difference that has to be talked about. If I wasn't here this morning walking along the Columbia River as I was as the sun came over Mount Hood and beyond, it was a beautiful, beautiful morning, I would have been with my friends Todd and Mark, the Caribou Coffee in our neighborhood. We meet every Wednesday morning. We've chosen to live this way by the creed of the Clapham community of a couple hundred years ago, to choose a neighbor before you choose a house. We've chosen to live nearby each other, and to meet together and have holidays together and raise our children together and think and talk and pray and work together. But my friend Todd, after many years of being a chief of staff in the Senate and then for State Department, he and a friend started the Telos group. And it raises a very unpopular question for the church and the world, sadly. And the argument they make is there's no real future for the Middle East unless you take seriously the history and hopes of both Israeli and Palestinian people. Now, I don't know you well enough in this room, all of you, to know what you think about that idea. Those are fighting words for some people, sadly, but they're words of life for other people, actually. If you think it through carefully, there's no real future if it's simply going to be one more version of eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Because you see, that's the way most people sadly want it to be. You kill me, I kill you. You kill my son, I kill your son. You do this, I'll do that. And it goes that way on and on and on and on and on. So for my friend Todd and his friend Gregory Khalil, whose family was born in Bethlehem, he has 70 cousins in Bethlehem, Gregory Khalil, but they worked together trying to bring people from America in particular into the Bethlehems of the world and the West Banks of the world and the Jerusalems of the world. And they rigorously, religiously required the pilgrims that come with them to actually meet people on both sides of the story. That almost never happens. It almost never works out that way. Because you see why? Well, this group says you only must talk to these people. This group says you only must meet these people to hear both sides, to hear the conflict, to hear the division, to hear the complexity, to hear the longing and the heartache of both peoples. That's harder work, really. But my friend Todd is committed to that in his life and his labor. He gave me a few years ago a little artful creation, I suppose, but it's three blocks, and it's three words in the languages of Hebrew, Arabic, and English. The three words, the three blocks are simply do unto others. Do unto others. There's clearly a sense in which if we were people who had that in our minds and hearts, that we will live that way, individually, institutionally, personally, publicly. We would, in fact, have a different way to live in this country, I think. Well, a last word as we begin our time together. A few weeks ago, I was in Birmingham, Alabama for a few days. One of the board members for our organization lives there, and he invited me to come speak to a variety of settings of his friends and fellow citizens in Birmingham. Because I'm a long apprentice to a man named Walker Percy, I was thinking about Percy having been born in Birmingham a long time ago, and all the while I was there. So I was speaking to artists and citizens and people who care about the arts, people in business and the church and education and medicine and all over the city. I kept thinking about Walker Percy and his rejoinder to the New York literary critics who said to him finally, when they gave him the award for the best book of fiction done that year. And he said, no. He said, you misread me. They said to him, well, we finally found our own American Albert Camus. You're somebody who looks at the bleakness of the human condition and you don't blink. You look it right in the eye. All of its depression right in the eye. All of its weariness right in the eye. All of its worn outness right in the eye. And Percy said back, no, you misread me. Always there's some hint of hope in my writing. There's always a hint of hope in my writing. In different ways, I kept offering that image to these people I met with. In this city and in this state full of glories and shames as it is, as pretty a place as it is, as good a football as is played in Alabama, as good as its people and its food are, The letter from the Birmingham jail and the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing still hang over the city and the state. But we're not fated as human beings. We do get to choose. Our responsibility is the secret of our humanity. Stepping into history with our commitments and our loves, our beliefs and our hopes, we do get to choose. We'd be romantics to imagine that this world is anything other than a wounded world, a bent world in C.S. Lewis's imagery in his space trilogy. It's a love in the ruins. Remember Walker Percy's novel? It is a love in the ruins that is ours to give, and that's okay. We're blessed by God to be that and to do that. We're in fact called by God into that calling. So, hints of hope we are to be, brothers and sisters. I can live with that. We can all live with that. In fact, we cannot live without that. If more is required of us than being a hint of hope, then it's too much. How is anything else possible given the sorrows and the pains of life that are not only so personal, but so public? It's enough to have to live with ourselves and our disappointments and our hurts, but to have to live with that with the rest of the world too, we groan and we should. But you see, being a hint of hope sounds almost possible. And that is the vocation of everyone, everywhere.